I have tried to summarize briefly on the blackboard what I'm trying to get at. You have, first of all, God's moral word for man, and that I believe includes God's economic law word for man. On the one hand, you have man's obedient response to that economic law word, resulting in God's blessing, man's prosperity. Jesus says, "Seek you first the kingdom of God, all these things will be added unto you." On the right hand of the blackboard, you have a diagram of man's disobedient response to God's economic law word. And last week, we showed how part of that disobedience showed itself in debt, usury, exploitation, one's fellow man, greed, love of money, and so on. God's judgment upon this is, we said, shown or reflected in inflation and the consequent lower standard of living. Now, in the lecture we gave on inflation, we touched briefly on the origin of inflation, the real reason for inflation. And we saw it has something to do with over-increasing the supply of money. And so today we come to the origin and nature of banking to show how this over-supply of money comes about. And in this listing of various kinds of man's disobedient response, I would put the fractional reserve banking system, and that we're going to talk about this morning. The fractional reserve. So just make a note of that. And I'm not going to give all this lecture. You are supposed to read this on your own as part of your homework. Now, where did this idea of fractional reserve banking come from as practiced in present-day banking? Well, the answer is the present-day banker has three ancestors of particular note: the merchant, the money lender, and the goldsmith. First, the merchant financier. Towards the end of the Middle Ages, there arose great merchant financiers whose high and widespread reputation or credit enabled them to issue documents which were taken all over the known world as titles to money. The names of several of these great merchant financiers are writ large on late medieval and Renaissance finance. The Bardi, Borussi, belonging to the Lombards, their place was taken in Italy by the Medici and the Strozzi. Germany produced the Fuggers and the Rothschilds, who of course are still with us in America. While the financiers were developing the loan business, other important banking developments took place among the merchants. Many of these centered on the improvement of arrangements for transferring funds. Payment could always be made, of course, by delivery of coins, but for large sums, this was distinctly inconvenient. The multitude of devices which arose to ease the burdens of transfer almost defy description. At the heart of many transfers lies the bill of exchange, which is essentially an order by one person to another, requiring him to make payment to a third. The bank check is a modern bill of exchange. The bill of exchange was certainly used extensively in the later Middle Ages, especially at the great international fairs. Elaborate machinery was devised for offsetting debts against each other by means of book transactions, without the need for using cash, except for the settlement of the net balances. Among the institutions developed to facilitate the handling of both foreign and domestic bills of exchange, the great bourses, especially those at Antwerp and Lyons, were the most important. Just as the fairs brought together the buyers and sellers of commodities, so the bourses brought together the buyers and sellers of bills. The provision of an organized market in which such instruments could be traded made it a great deal easier to match the financial needs of merchants and others who wanted to transfer funds. Later, the bourses became centers for the flotation of government debt, and they also operated as channels through which other loans could be placed. Secondly, just put in the blank space there, the money lenders. Lending and borrowing are almost as old as money itself. And the village money lender is found even in quite primitive communities. He is not usually regarded as a very lovely object, but the services he performs are useful and necessary, even though the reward he exacts in return may usually be rapacious. The money lender, to begin with, works with his own capital. But if there are other members of the community with money to spare, it will be quite natural for them to entrust it to the money lender for investment, in view of his skill and technique of exaction. As soon as the money lender reaches this stage, he is an embryonic banker. He has become a money borrower as well as a money lender. At first, he may lend out his client's money on commission, just as present-day, just as the present-day lawyer does. But it is obviously both more convenient for his clients and more profitable for him to borrow their money outright, paying interest on it and mingling it with his own capital, then to lend out the whole amount, making his profit from the differences between the moderate rate of interest he pays to his lending clients and the high rate he charges his borrowing clients. Please cross out the next paragraph. We've dealt with that in the lecture on the Christian view of debts. That's the next paragraph erased. Now, every bank has a very great deal of the money lender in its composition. It collects money from those who have it to spare, or who are saving it out of their income, and lends this money out to those who require it. This is a valuable and necessary function in any society. Indeed, as we have seen, it is a function of the most peculiar importance if a modern complex economy is to work properly. Many institutions which call themselves banks perform no other function than this. A savings bank, for example, performs precisely this function, except that its funds are usually used to buy investments instead of making loans directly to individuals. A mortgage bank is more exactly analogous to a money lender, as its function consists entirely in collecting individual savings and lending them out to other individuals who wish to borrow for the purpose of building or buying a house. Even commercial banks spend a great deal of their time and energy in this business of collecting dispersing savings. If this were their only function, however, the lecture could stop here. We've hitherto been talking of people who have the money to spare, that is, money which they don't wish to keep on hand for the ordinary expenses of life, and which as well, therefore, be put out where they can earn some interest. But in the present age, the banks are concerned with far more than that. The ordinary bank depositor keeps all his money in the bank and makes his daily payments out of it. Moreover, the banks are not content with merely collecting other people's money and lending it out again. As we have seen, they play their part in creating or manufacturing the community's supply of money. A clear line can therefore be drawn between the bank, in the ordinary sense of the term, and those institutions which, whether they call themselves banks or not, are merely the present-day descendants of the money lender. The IOUs of a savings bank or a mortgage bank do not circulate as money. Those of a commercial bank do. That is the vital distinction. Money, it has been said, has two properties. It is flat, so it can be piled up. It is also round, so it can circulate. The progeny of the money lender are concerned with flat money, piled up money, savings. The progeny of the goldsmith are concerned with round money, circulating money, cash. Commercial banks of America and elsewhere perform both functions. We have already traced their descent on one side from the money lender and the merchant financier. We must now turn to the other ancestor, the goldsmith. Three, the goldsmith. The goldsmith ancestry of the modern commercial bank is purely an English affair. Indeed, the bank, as a provider of circulating money, is almost entirely an English invention, which has not yet spread to every part of the civilized world. Part of every goldsmith's necessary stock in trade is a secure safe. Without it, he could hardly stay in business. And a goldsmith, even today, will frequently oblige his customers by keeping their gold and silver plate in his safe. In a period when money consisted entirely of gold and silver, and forms of investment, except in land, were almost non-existent, private persons owned proportionately much more gold and silver than they do at present. What more natural thing than to entrust it to the goldsmith for safekeeping and to get a receipt? In London, the merchants of the city for many years kept their gold in the Tower of London. But when King Charles I, hard-pressed for money, seized the merchant's gold in the Tower in 1640, the goldsmiths naturally got the business to themselves. In the beginning, this was a pure safe deposit business, and the deposit receipts were used only for the purpose of withdrawing the gold. But the stages of development into the full-blown bank of today were rapid and easy. First, the deposit receipts began to be handed around as money. It was certainly more convenient to pay debts by handing over a slip of paper than to withdraw gold, hand it over again, and then redeposit it. So the deposit receipt, once the goldsmith's name and reputation became well known, became the embryonic banknote. Second, even the deposit receipt could be dispensed with. The goldsmith could merely be instructed by letter to transfer the ownership of such and such an amount of gold from the original depositor to his creditor. This is the birth of the check. The earliest check on London goldsmith banker, which has been preserved for posterity, is dated 1675. And finally, the goldsmith, now fully developed into banker, makes the discovery he can safely issue deposit receipts in excess of his gold stock. It is immaterial whether he does this by printing off more receipts and lending them to persons in need of a loan, or indeed using them to pay his own household bills, or whether he does it by allowing his customers larger deposits on which they can draw by check than the value of the gold they have deposited. In either case, the crucial step has been taken. The principle of the creation of money by means of the fractional reserve method of banking has been discovered. Please, partners. You can read the illustration for yourselves before you go to bed tonight. I'm going to put you to sleep. Just turn over the page, please, to page 3, the second from the last paragraph on the bottom. Underline the first sentence of the second paragraph from the bottom on page 3. The essence of fractional reserve banking lies in the creation of more demand liabilities which circulate as money than the banker would be able to pay if all creditors asked for payment at the same time. The quantity of goldsmith's notes that can be issued against a given reserve depends entirely on the actual desire of note holders to redeem them in coin. This desire, in turn, depends on the temper of the times and the goldsmith's attempts to estimate it on the basis of past experience. If not more than half his customers have ever come in asking for redemption at one time, before others have come in to make new deposits, the goldsmith can afford to keep only half his deposits in coin, plus some additional amount as a margin of safety. Putting the matter another way, he can afford to issue notes, by loan or otherwise, in an amount equal to approximately twice his gold reserve. If no more than 10% of his creditors ask for coin at the same time, he may presumably lower his reserve to 10%, creating notes up to 10 times his reserve. But heaven help him if he underestimated. Suppose he had 50% reserve, But suddenly, people wanted more coin for some reason and demanded it in excess of his stock. He would be bankrupt. In his early period, he would very likely be tarred and feathered or even drowned in the nearest mill pond. This sudden desire on the part of note holders to get their money back in cash is referred to as a run on the bank. Samuel Pepys' diary records the first such bank run known in history when the defeat of the British fleet by the Dutch Navy at Chatham led to a general rush to obtain gold. The calculation of the amount of money which a goldsmith may lend on the basis of a given reserve of gold became both a science and art. Those who kept too large a reserve of gold lost the opportunity of earning interest on a larger note circulation. Those who kept too small a reserve suffered failure on the day of retribution. There was found to be no formula for discovering the magic number. Only experience, wisdom, and perhaps a little luck would give the answers. And of course, the figure changed as business conditions changed. 50% reserves were too low in the early days of fractional reserve banking. 2% in cash seems adequate at most times for banks in our highly developed financial markets in the United States today. The Bank of Goldsmiths illustrate perfectly the basic principles of commercial banking today and their money-creating function. You please ask those people outside to keep quiet. I repeat, the Bank of Goldsmiths illustrate perfectly the basic principles of commercial banking today and their money-creating function. The development, like that of most institutions, was a slow one. But they gradually emerged into the forefront of monetary institutions, finally giving up the original goldsmith's craft and turning their attention exclusively to finance. After the Great Fire of London in 1666 burned a goldsmith's row, they moved to Lombard Street, thus inheriting the location as well as much of the business of the Italian Lombards, who started the banks in England, who started the exchange types of banks in the Middle Ages. The time then was right for the development of banking on a larger, more highly organized and less individual scale. New forms, new institutions emerged, but the basic principles of the goldsmiths remain to this day. The present-day banker then shows traces of each of his three ancestors. Like the merchant, he still makes a speciality of financing foreign trade and has special methods, such as the issue of bills of exchange for doing so. Like the money lender, he still collects the savings of one set of persons and lends them to another set. A large part of his deposits consists of so-called deposit accounts, or savings or time deposits, which cannot be drawn upon without due notice. These deposits are clearly not circulating money. They are flat money, entrusted by those to the money lender for placing. Both of these functions are important in their own way. Notice, underline please, the unique function of the modern commercial banker is a third: the provision of a convenient mechanism by which people can make payments to each other without having to walk around to each other's houses with bags full of coin. And in providing this mechanism, he also provides or creates the money itself. He has discovered the secret for which the medieval alchemists strove for so long of manufacturing money. So at least it seems on the surface. Now we must examine more closely this apparently miraculous business of money creation out of thin air. Let us suppose the ordinary borrower goes to his bank for a loan of $100. He convinces the banker he will be able to pay the interest and repay the principal, and that the loan will be safe in his hands. He gets the loan. What precisely happens next? The banker doesn't go to his safe and draw out $100 in gold and hand it over to the borrower. If the banker is permitted by the law to issue notes, he may make the loan by handing over $100 of his dollar bills straight from the printing press. But the most usual method of making a loan is merely to credit the account of the borrower with $100 in his deposit account. The borrower may draw some of the $100 out in cash, but he's more likely to spend it by check, in which case the $100 is withdrawn from his account but credited to somebody else's. The point to notice is the loan is made by increasing the banker's debt. The banker has, in return, the borrower's promise to repay the loan at interest. But the granting of the loan has increased the banker's debt. In the words of the old banking maxim, every loan creates a deposit. The banker's debts, whether notes or deposits, serve as money. As a result of the loan, therefore, an additional $100 of new money has come into existence. When the loan is repaid, the borrower's account will be debited with $100, and the cancellation of the loan will thus remove $100 of bank money out of existence. Making loans is not the only way in which deposits can be created. If a banker buys $100 of securities on the stock exchange and pays for them by crediting the seller's account with $100, he has increased his deposits, which are bank money, by $100. Purchase of $100 worth of securities by any bank increases the deposits either of his own bank or some other bank. In any case, the deposits of banks as a whole by $100. What is true of the purchase of securities is true of the acquisition of any asset. A bank can buy itself a new building by giving the builder bank deposits in payment, which explains why banks alone can afford such palatial palaces. They become the temples of the modern world in which men worship the almighty dollar rather than almighty God. And of course, all gods demand proper temples in which to be worshipped, and hence the beautiful buildings put up by most banks. A bank, indeed, is in the happy position of being able to acquire anything it wants by giving its IOUs in exchange. It can do this because its IOUs are regarded as money and really press for payment in cash. Just as anyone can create his own IOUs, so the banker can create money and use it to buy what he wants. But it must never be forgotten, the money the banker creates is his liability. The whole system turns on the fact that very few of the banker's IOUs will be pressed for payment in cash and add at the same time. But some of them will be. This need for keeping a cash reserve, however small it may be, does impose a restriction upon the power of the bank to create money ad lib. Creating money involves an increase in the bank's deposit liabilities, and the bank cannot afford to let its cash reserve fall below 10% of its total deposit liabilities. It might indeed be safe to let the cash ratio fall to 8 or even 6%, but the public has grown so accustomed to the existing ratio, it would begin to look askance at a bank which allowed its cash ratio to fall below the usual figure. Unlike other people, a banker not only cannot do things which endanger his position, he cannot even do things which people think might endanger his position. His whole business depends upon the confidence of the public in his ability to meet his liabilities on demand. The word credit, for example, comes from the Latin word I believe. What do I believe? I believe in the other businessman's honesty and truthfulness. I believe in the banker's honesty. And so underlying our whole free enterprise system is this faith in each other as men who will respect and honor their contracts. Now, if the banker's reserves are enormous, nobody will question his ability to pay on demand. But if they are falling below the figure to which the public is accustomed, nervous depositors will begin to wonder if, after all, the banker could meet all his liabilities. And they'll begin to draw their deposits out in cash, just to be sure. No banker today could pay all his liabilities in cash on demand if they were all to be presented at once, at the same time. In that sense, every banker is always insolvent. But the banker's whole business depends absolutely upon his reputation for solvency, upon the public's belief in his ability to pay every demand upon him in cash without question or hesitation. The bigger his cash reserves, the less he will need them. The less cash he has, the more he will need them. Any prudent banker, then, will make it an unbreakable rule of his business never to let his cash fall below a certain proportion of his deposit liability. Underline the next point. Banks, then, can only create money up to the total of about 10 times their cash reserves. Bank cash means some form of money with which the bank can pay its debts if called upon to do so. But the deposit money which the bank creates cannot serve to pay its debts, for these deposits are the bank's debts. The amount of actual cash which a bank has at its disposal, or more accurately, the amount of cash which all the banks have at their combined disposal, is beyond the individual bank's power to determine. The bank's power of creating bank money is thus limited by the cash it can get its hands on. $1 of cash gained makes possible $9 or $10 of additional creation of bank money. But if $1 of cash is lost, $9 or $10 of bank deposits must be destroyed. This is the first limitation on the bank's power of creating money. The second limitation arises out of the nature of the profits by which deposits come into existence. As we have seen, deposits arise out of the acquisition of some asset or other, either a loan owed the bank by a borrower, or a security, or a building. Now, every asset is a form of wealth. This can easily be seen in the case of stocks or buildings. Nearly every loan made by a bank is secured upon some form of valuable security. Even if it is granted without security, the earning capacity of the borrower is a form of wealth. Thus, the bank does not create money out of thin air. Underline this. It transmutes other forms of wealth into money. Even the medieval alchemists never hoped to make gold out of nothing. Their highest hope was to transform lead into gold. The banker can turn immobile wealth into the mobile or liquid form of wealth known as money. He takes the immobile wealth as his asset and gives you his IOU, which is bank money, in exchange. This is the very essence of the banker's business. And as you know, during the slump, we had a dreadful example of bank exploitation. They took many of the farms in the Midwest of Canada, the United States, as security. And when the poor farmers went bankrupt, these bankers finished up owning hundreds and thousands of farms throughout Canada and America. Now, the confidence of the public and the soundness of the bank invests the bank's promises to pay with the qualities of real money. That is to say, the public uses these promises to make its purchases and to pay its debts. But it should be clearly understood they are not money in this sense to the bank. To the public, a bank note is the representation of an asset. To the bank, it is a representation of a liability. When a bank increases its notes or deposits, it increases its liabilities. And it is only right. It should be compensated for doing so. The misconception of this fact is at the bottom of much loose thinking about the nature of the banking system. It is true that the higher the deposits or notes of a bank, the higher are its profits. Banks are therefore always anxious to increase their liabilities. However, the bank makes its profits not out of its liabilities,
but out of the assets it is acquired in exchange for its liabilities. When he makes a loan, it does so by increasing the number of its promises to pay. But it makes its profits out of the borrower's promises to pay, not out of its own. The two things originate in the same transaction, but they are quite separate. If the asset disappears, the liability on the notes remains. If the liability disappears, if notes are destroyed, the asset remains. Now please turn over to page 6B. You can read the next page on your own. I try to be as fair as I can in explaining the nature of modern banking based upon this principle of the fractional reserve. Now, what are some of the weaknesses and dangers of fractional reserve banking? Well, the first one we've come across briefly before, what I call multiple indebtedness. And this reminds you, simply means that I put in $100 to the bank. The bank takes $80 of that and lends it to B, and 10 to C. So you have a chain then of multiple indebtedness. Now the system of banking we just described is known as fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserves typify the basic principle by which commercial banks create money. The reserves, cash or its equivalent held by a commercial bank, are less than, that is, a fraction of its demand deposits. If a bank had to maintain 100% reserves, that is, in cash, it could not lend money, and hence could not increase the money supply. By keeping only a fraction of the total, the bank can lend the rest and expand the money supply. Money supply, this time we get in terms of figures in the bank ledgers known as bank deposits. When we use the word money in economics, we put it with capital letters, because today money takes a variety of forms. You and I generally think of money in terms of dollar bills and coins. Bankers think of money in a variety of ways, as we will see. And one of the main forms taken by money today is this business of the bank deposits. So, by keeping only a fraction of the total, the bank can lend the rest and expand the money supply in the form of bank deposits. Thus, with a 10% reserve requirement imposed by the central bank, a single deposit of $100 can be used to create $900 worth of loans throughout the entire banking system. Such fractional reserve banking has vastly outstripped the Treasury's printing of paper money as a means of inflating the money supply. It should be obvious, such a system of banking is in complete violation of the biblical prohibition upon multiple indebtedness. You remember we said that if you gave out your cloak as security for a loan, the man who loaned you the money had to return that cloak to you every night. So neither he nor you could go around trying to get an extra loan or an additional loan on the same original security. Then I quote from William Rodker. You read it for yourself. Go to the bottom of the page, please. It might be objected that the individual bank adverse clearing balances, as well as the Federal Reserve's legal reserve requirement, places some restraint upon the bank's power to manufacture a credit. By adverse clearing balances, bankers refer to the fact that when an individual bank makes loans to its customers, there is a good chance they will write checks to people who do business with the other banks. When this happens, the individual bank has to pay cash to the other bank. In a mini-bank system such as America's, the most important limitation on the power of individual banks to expand credit to the legal limit permitted by its reserves is the fear it will lose its own cash reserves to other banks. If Bank A has to pay cash to Bank B, when they settle up, the checks written back and forth between their customers, It is said that Bank A has an adverse clearing balance. And to a bank, an adverse clearing balance is just like a currency drain. It takes away its cash reserves. Secondly, the weakness of inflation and deflation. Now, the commercial banking system in the United States not only encourages multiple indebtedness, it also contributes significantly to business fluctuation. Sometimes our banking system has expanded credit too rapidly. For example, during World War II, the banking system created $100 billion worth of new deposits by buying new government securities or bonds from the U.S. Treasury. During each war loan drive, the banks bought billions of dollars of new government bonds and paid for them by giving the government demand deposits to spend. In a war loan drive, for example, the banks would buy $10 billion of new governmental bonds, and the corresponding $10 billion of new deposits would be created on a single day. The banks would enter $10 billion of deposits for the U.S. government on their books with a matching asset of $10 billion of new bonds they had acquired. The government could then spend the money, and the new deposits became part of the money supply for spending and re-spending. Never before had America seen such mass creation of deposits. Never before had the process of bank credit creation been demonstrated with such simplicity. As a direct result, there took place a tremendous inflation of the nation's prices. A part of our present inflation can likewise be traced back to the deficit financing of the war in Vietnam began by President Johnson. And notice, the money creation process works in reverse. If $1 of reserves is the basis of $5 of outstanding bank deposits created by loans and investments, the loss of each dollar of reserves may force contraction of $5 in deposits. Indeed, if banks are fully loaned up to the legal reserve limit, loss of reserves must cause a contraction of deposits, and hence of loans and investments. Such a contraction of credit is brought about when banks reduce their loans or investments, which is what they're doing right now. They're calling in loans all over the place, which is why the bank credit analyst is advising people to be very careful now. We may be on the verge of a collapse similar to that in the 1930s. If the banks run short of reserves and cannot obtain more, they reduce their deposits by calling loans as they come due or by selling bonds. As with credit expansion, credit contraction snowballs in a massive way. Please write in. It should be in the Great Depression of the 1930s, for example, and in 1/3 of the nation's money supply, mainly demand deposits, was wiped out through the contraction of bank loans and investments. Banks lost their reserves rapidly as the public withdrew currency. This forced the banks to call for payment of loans. Deposits fell from $46 billion to $30 billion between 29 and 33. Please turn over the page. Another weakness which is tied in with this type of fractional reserve banking is the principle of limited liability. The principle of limited liability has also contributed to the financial instability of our economic system. The development of double entry bookkeeping during the Middle Ages had made it possible to account for the size of a business's assets. Thus, the business owners could determine their share of the assets as well as their proportion of its profits or losses. The new accounting arrangement led to the growth of the joint stock company, an organization in which usually more than two or three businessmen take part, because a record could be kept of what was happening to the original investment in the business. At first, like the proprietorship and the partnership, the joint stock company did not protect the investor against losses larger than his original investment. The result was that no matter how tempting it was, a businessman didn't wish to invest his funds in a new venture if he was liable to lose not only what he put into it, but also part or all of his family's fortune. should the business incur debts larger than its total assets. This system of doing business may have impeded speculative enterprises such as the ill-fated South Sea Company, which raised loans both for the British government and the East India Company. In 1720, the bubble burst and the ruined investors demanded justice. A number of directors were found guilty and punished by heavy fines on their estates. This experience engendered a long-lasting distrust of joint stock organizations. For one thing, the British Parliament passed the South Sea Bubble Act in 1719, which required every company to possess a charter and made every investor liable for the private debts of the individual partners. And quote from the Act, and subject to be torn in pieces upon the bankruptcy of any of them. I think if our bankers have that threat hanging over their heads today, they might be a bit more careful. Take them down to Main Square and pull them apart. At the same time, the Act encouraged investors to be responsible in their investment decisions. By the 19th century, private banks and other companies began to lobby in the British Parliament and the United States Congress for limited liability. Under limited liability, a participating investor could lose only what he'd originally invested. His personal property, house and land holdings, remained unattachable. In 1855, Parliament allowed certain joint stock companies to register with limited liability. In 1862, an act was passed, throwing open to all the coveted privilege of carrying on business with limited liability. In the United States, some states, such as New York, made legal the limited liability company. But such corporations were not regarded favorably by the general public. Professor John A. Garrity in the American Nation explains the reason. While banks and the device of the corporation, limited liability, existed, were being used increasingly to create and concentrate capital, prejudices against them did not disappear. Throughout this period, 1800 to 1850, anyone interested in organizing a corporation had to obtain a special act of a state legislature. Furthermore, even among businessmen, there was a tendency to associate corporations with monopoly, with corruption, with the undermining of individual enterprise. The opponents of the limited liability company, known in America as the corporation, argued it would ultimately undermine capitalism and the free market economy. They believed the principle of individual responsibility, which is basic to good business practice and the free enterprise system, was at stake in the issue. The limited liability company has one outstanding feature. It is inherently irresponsible, having neither a body to be kicked nor a soul to be damned. As directors of a company, wrote William N. Gouge, men will sanction actions of which they would scorn to be guilty in their private capacity. A crime which would press heavily on the conscience of one man becomes quite endurable when divided among many. Unlike the old partnerships, the new corporations which grew up during the 19th century were held responsible in law only for the value of their assets. Yet these assets were invariably less than the amount of indebtedness, since it is for this reason the company went bankrupt. Of the moral significance of this, Rushdoony well comments in his book, The Politics of Guilt and Pity. Liability is inescapable. By limiting the liability of the company, which contracts the debt or commits a fraud, the liability thus shifts responsibility away from the responsible wrongdoer to society at large. A partner or shareholder in a company will exercise cautious and conscientious control over his company if his liability for the debts and frauds of that company are not limited to the extent of his investment. The result is sound, moral, and careful management of a company by the actual owners. But with limited liability, A premium is placed on profit irrespective of responsibility. The shareholder is less concerned with buying responsible ownership and more concerned with buying a share in profit. Then, as the state further protects the shareholder against liabilities in his irresponsible pursuit of profits, the shareholder becomes less and less concerned with the responsible and moral management of his company. I think that's a very important comment of Raduni. I would add to that that I believe, upon reflection, the principle of the limited liability company works against the biblical principle of good stewardship. You can only be a good steward if you are held responsible to somebody. And God, working through institutions of law and society, holds businessmen and workers responsible to the law. Now, by limiting responsibility, you're opening up the gates for irresponsible, the exercise of irresponsible economic power. And I really think that if we're going to recover a biblical view of stewardship in modern business, we're going to have to drastically reduce this whole idea of limited liability. I quote then from Schumpeter in Capitalism, Social Democracy, and he has another angle about this. He says that limited liability brings about the divorce of the control of capital, the ownership of capital, from its management. And this in turn opens up the way for the coming of socialism. Because he says that if you don't really feel identified with your company, all you're worried about is getting some dividends at the end of the year, then you don't really care very much as to what happens to the company. And so he says the modern corporation is no longer acting as a strong barrier it once was against socialization by the state. The two paragraphs down, please, on page 9. It should be noted that both fractional reserve banking and the limited corporations are creations of the modern state. Now, that in itself, you see, shows that something has gone wrong, because in our Christian view, the banks and the corporations are held to be directly responsible to the Lord Jesus Christ. They are His creation. When He created the world, in principle, He had in mind the setting up of banks and limited liability companies. And it's taken all this time in history to bring out into the open this original plan God had for society. Therefore, the state has no business, you see, to be interfering in this way with the economic organization of society. The state now guarantees to certain favored groups in society special immunity from God's law against debt and multiple indebtedness. Ludwig von Mises has shown in Human Action that fractional reserve banks could hardly exist were it not for this intrusion of the government into the private sector of the economy. The same is true for limited liability companies. Both institutions have served to further the state's own purposes rather than those of the market economy and, I might add, of the people. The banking system has provided both the federal and state governments with a source of ready loans, and limited liability companies can easily become the instruments for nationalization and government takeover. And both have been based upon a flagrant violation of God's prohibition against multiple indebtedness. As a result, both institutions are now under God's judgment, who will not be disobeyed with men suffering great loss, as I pointed out in the opening lecture, because if God is still sovereign, His sovereignty reveals itself either in terms of His blessing upon man's obedient economic response to the economic law worth of creation, or His sovereignty reveals itself in God's judgment upon man's disobedience. As Rasuti points out, it can be argued that limited liability company destroyed capitalism.
Now, get this. I mean, this is a fantastic comment of his.
Free enterprise requires risk, and the risk is taken by the capitalist, by the entrepreneur, that means the business enterprises. If there is protection from risk, there is protection from freedom. And if the risk is passed on to others at state instigation, it logically follows that the farmer and the worker can also claim some form of limited liability from risk, some protection from consequences. Risk is inescapable in any and every society. In a free society, full responsibility is assumed by individuals or associations. It is their duty to protect themselves by prudent measures, and failing that, to assume the consequences. When the risk is assumed by the state and by society at large, the ultimate failure of the entire order is assured in that the irresponsibility of all the people is encouraged. Capitalism and limited liability are alien concepts. In other words, you say there that you can't have a truly free enterprise system as long as you have limited liability. And point four, amongst the weaknesses, limited liability and increased debt. The outcome of limited liability, as the principle of organization of modern commerce and banking, add their banking because the banks, as we also claim limited liability, has been a fantastic increase in corporation debt. And I give you a further quote from his journey to prove that. Now, what about some proposals for reform? We have a few moments left. I'm not going to go over all this last part. Just make these three suggestions. In view of the important part bank credit expansion and contraction play in business cycles and in inflating the nation's money supply, some concerned economists have advocated the following reform. First of all, they demand 100% reserve requirements. Men such as von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Gary North, advocate 100% reserve requirements behind all bank deposits instead of the present 13%. They argue that this step would do much to lessen the severity of business fluctuations. They point out that businessmen and others who wish to borrow could continue to do so through savings and loan associations. These organizations would receive savings from the public, but they could lend out underline only as much money as savers had first deposited, rather than being able to create or manufacture credit as the banks presently do. Such a step would at once put a stop to credit expansion of money which had not first been earned by society, that is, through production of real wealth, and hence put a stop to inflation caused by bank credit expense. In the United States today, the total cash reserves of all commercial banks are about $70 billion, and the total deposits, demand plus savings, are nearly $500 billion. North rightly argues it is this enormous discrepancy which is mainly responsible for the spiraling inflation of prices in America today, and that soon the bubble must burst again, as it did with the South Sea Company in 1719. He believes only a policy of the demonetization of debt, underline that word, demonetization, can now save us from national bankruptcy, since it will bring a drastic decline in prices, forcing them more into line with the actual production of goods and services. Second proposal they advocate is free banking. Von Mises and North also advocate free banking. Under such a system, the banks will be made to gain their profits not from the unlimited expansion of credit, but from charging a storage cost for people's savings, clearinghouse operations for checks, and the wise investment of private trust funds. When banks create credit, and the power of credit creation, as we have seen, is precisely what now defines a bank, they charge interest on loan funds which have been created out of thin air. There are no gold or silver reserves backing this money, yet the banks profit by it. This surely involves fraud and is therefore immoral. As Murray Rothbard points out in Man, Economy, and the State, this process of money creation has also been called the monetization of debt, an apt term, since it describes the only instance when a liability can be transformed into money, the supreme asset. It is obvious the more money the bank creates, the more profits it will earn, for any income earned on newly created money is pure unalloyed gain. The bank has been able to alter the conditions of the free market system, in which money can be obtained only by purchase, mining, or gift. In each of these routes, productive service, either of one's own or one's ancestors, was necessary in order to create money. The bank's inflationary intervention has created another route to money, the creation of the new money out of thin air by issuing receipts for non-existent gold. The banks are deliberately trying to climb out from under the Genesis curse. In the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat thy bread. But no, the banks say, we're going to enjoy our wealth simply by playing around with figures and bank ledgers. Under free banking, the commercial banks would function as investment clearing houses, investing the savings of their customers in those enterprises which promised to be the most successful. Banks would not be allowed unlimited funds to loan, but they would be limited in the credit they could extend by the amount of their gold reserves. In order to remain in business, to make profits, and thus attract the savings of investors, banks would have to make their loans judiciously. They'd have to seek out those ventures which they judge to be most sound and potentially profitable. Point 3, limited liability must be abolished so that all investors are forced to assume full responsibility for the companies in which they own shares. Such a drastic step would make all shareholders attend the annual meetings of the companies in which they now hold shares and keep track of what the managements of such companies are doing. For a discussion of how such a reform might work, you should read the Christian Layman's book, The Responsible Company, by George Goider. Point 5, North also suggests a completely free coinage, with the government only acting as disinterested third party to step in and prosecute at the first sign of fraud on the part of the private firms selling such coins of gold and silver. Any debasement of these private coins will be prosecuted to the limit of the law. Thus, the private mints will find it to their advantage to keep continual watch over each other's gold and silver coins, calling attention to any sign of fraud. By eliminating the present state monopoly of coinage, private competition would act as a safeguard to monetary fraud and the printing of worthless dollar bills. The Word of God regards precious metals as the primary basis of economic exchange and roundly condemns any debasement of such gold and silver coins. Isaiah 1, verse 21. Gold and silver are seen throughout the Bible as major sources of wealth, both public and private. To that list of references, please add the first reference in Scripture to gold is Genesis 2:12. Please look these up tonight, part of your devotion.
Proverbs 20.
No, not Proverbs, Genesis. Genesis 13:2, Genesis 2:12, 4:35, 2 Kings 23:33. On this matter, North writes, well over 350 references to gold appear in Strong's Concordance, about the same number of references to silver. The constant concern of Old Testament law with the honesty of weights and measures was equally applicable to honest money. Counterfeiting has to be punished. If private citizens do it, the state must intervene and punish the violators, since fraud and theft are both involved. Yet the state is also to be limited by this law of honest weights and measures. It must not force its citizens to accept a unit of money which is worth less in exchange than its face value. In short, legal tender laws are immoral. Currency debasement is immoral. printed on back paper money is immoral. The people must be given the right to claim their gold. The coinage power must be left to private citizens who are subject to competition from other citizens and to the enforcement by the government of the private coin stated weights and fines. End of quote. In case you should think North's proposal far-fetched, let me point out the English pound was in origin quite literally a pound of silver. The French franc stemmed from the livre, which was originally identical with the English pound. The dollar began as a generally applied name of an ounce of silver coined by a Bohemian count named Schlick in the 16th century. The Count of Schlick lived in Joachim's Valley, Bohemia. His coins earned a great reputation for their uniformity and fineness, and they were widely called Joachim's Thalers, or finally Thalers, from which the name dollar eventually emerged. I thank you.